Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris FX and our sponsor, Jump Desktop. I'm Steve Hallfish. I'm a working film, TV, and documentary editor. Over the last 9 years, I've done more than 400 interviews with world's best editors. Actually, it's the last 10 years. Welcome to episode 10 of season 10, and it's our 10th anniversary show. The first two episodes were March 1st, 2014, with Oscar winner Mark Sanger, ACE, for Gravity, and March 18th with Joe Walker, ACE, discussing 12 Years a Slave. I've been using Boris FX products for 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today on Art of the Cut, we're talking with multi-Oscar winner Walter Murch, ACE. I interviewed Walter in person just before his appearance at the 2024 Ace Eddie Awards to receive his Career Achievement Award, an award which was presented by his longtime friend and collaborator, George Lucas. Walter's career is filled with cinematic cultural touchstones. He was nominated for an Oscar for sound and won BAFTAs for both sound and editing on The Conversation. He was nominated for a BAFTA and an Oscar for editing Julia. For Apocalypse Now, he was nominated for an Oscar for editing, BAFTAs for editing and sound, and Ace Eddie, and won the Oscar for sound. In 1991, he was nominated for Oscars for both The Godfather Part II and Ghost, and was nominated for an Ace Eddie for Ghost. For The English Patient, he was nominated for a BAFTA for sound and won a BAFTA for editing, not to mention winning an Ace Eddie and two Oscars for sound and editing. He was nominated for an Ace Eddie for The Talented Mr. Ripley. He was nominated for two BAFTAs for sound and editing, and for an Ace Eddie and an Oscar for Cold Mountain. He was nominated for two BAFTAs for sound and editing, and for an Ace Eddie and an Oscar for Cold Mountain. He was nominated for an Emmy for Hemingway and Gellhorn, for which he also won an Ace Eddie. On top of all of this, he has been writing a book on filmmaking, actually two volumes, with the first volume releasing later this year, focusing on editing and sound, and the second volume coming out next year. Most of the following interview focuses on the thoughts and concepts outlined in that book, which is called Suddenly Something Clicked. Before I hop into our discussion with Walter, a brief thank you to our sponsors. Jump Desktop is a high-performance and secure app that lets you virtually connect to your editing bay as if you were physically there. Keep all your assets in one place and connect to your powerful editing bays from anywhere. Jump Desktop's high-performance remote desktop protocol lets you edit from any low-powered laptop. With end-to-end encryption, native support for macOS and Windows, and multi-monitor support, you can be productive from anywhere. Jump Desktop also has collaborative screen sharing for collaboration with your team. See what thousands of editors have been using to get their work done from across the world. Visit jumpdesktop.com/cut to begin your free, no limits, 14-day trial today. And to our partner, Boris FX. I've been using Boris FX and Sapphire for 30 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me to deliver on the creative vision of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris FX is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head on over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris FX suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optics, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, you can go to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC. That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmarked. And now, multi-Oscar winning editor and sound designer, Walter Murch, ACE. Walter, thank you so much for doing this interview with me. It's so nice to be talking with you again. You are about to publish a book. Do you know when the publication date is?
Later this year. We're in copy edit mode, and that will take another 6 weeks or so. And then there's galleys and there's a lot of pictures, so they all have to be cleared. So I hope by the end of the year. I should say it's going to be in two volumes. There's a volume one, which will come out this year, and another one will come out the following year.
From what I've read of the first one, I can't wait for both of them. I really loved many things, of course, that you said in the book, and I wanted to get some clarification or to hear your story a little bit more fully on some of these. I really loved the idea that in English, German, and Scandinavian, the word for editing
highlights kind of cutting down and reorganizing.
Yeah.
But you preferred the word montage. Can you explain why?
Well, it's montage in all of the Southern European languages, the languages influenced by Latin. And montage simply means to build. If you ask a plumber to come and put in some pipes, he will montage the pipes together. And that's what we have to do before we can do any cutting down. We have to build it up from all of the mosaic images that we've been getting while they're shooting. Of course, it's both. You know, it is both the building up and then the condensation. But I temperamentally prefer that word, I think.
And one of the other great parts about the book, for those many people, I'm sure, who will go out and buy it, is you've got little quotes along the bottom of the pages. And one of them that I love, but I want to hear how an editor could put this into practice, is inspiration comes, but it has to find you working.
That's Mr. Picasso, I think, said that. I mean, it's generally applicable to all of the creative businesses, whether you're a musician or a painter or a filmmaker, that you are sitting here in a room waiting for some asteroid of an idea to hit your brain. And if you just sit there, they tend not to hit you. Whereas if you actually take the first step, you do something, then the idea is, just to personalize them, the inspiration says, oh, well, maybe it should be like this. So you have angels who come to help you once you start on the voyage of whatever it is. And with everything, the first step is always the hardest to take.
Yeah, I always think that sometimes when I see a scene, I'm not inspired to do anything, but you just start doing something, right?
Yeah, exactly.
This is another quote from the book, or paraphrase possibly. Film should be coherent, but not too coherent, leaving strategic openings for the audience to project their own feelings. I definitely think that's true. What role does the editor play in making them not coherent?
This idea is also, I think, applicable to all of the arts, particularly to film, I think, because film seems to be so complete. You know, it is multisensory, it's image and sound, and the closeness to the person's face or the widest possible landscape shot, we have a great range of different scopes that we can use. And so the tendency is to use that and sort of bludgeon the audience into accepting what you have to say. And that's effective, you know, you can do it, but I don't think you're getting under the skin of the audience when you do that. I like to say that film is a mass intimate art because we want to appeal to as many people as possible, hopefully in a theater where there are lots of people at the same time. But we also want each person to feel, this film is talking to me because it's talking about things only I know. Mm-hmm. And that comes when the film allows, let's say, openings, little ambiguities in the way the actors perform, or ambiguities in the way the script is written, or ambiguities in the way the film is put together editorially. Initially, the audience maybe subconsciously says, that doesn't quite make sense. As soon as you hear that internal idea subconsciously, the mind says, oh, I know, I can complete it, but you're completing it out of your own experience. And the weird alchemy of this is that you then project the results of that onto the screen, and you actually kind of see what it is that you have done with your head. And so you're looking at the film thinking, how does that film know what's in my secret heart? So that's an ideal. And there are many places where films can do that at every craft. Production design can do it. Sound can do it. Music can certainly do it. Mm-hmm. But it also has to come from the original conception of the work at the script level, at the story level.
One of the big things that you and I have talked about that you mentioned in this book and that you've kind of adopted as a way of editing is nodality, this idea of nodality. Right. Could you explain a little bit about what that means to you?
An aligned word is the knot in a tree. You know, you cut a piece of wood out of a tree, you can see the knot, and the knot is the remnants of where a branch broke off from the main trunk, or a twig broke off from the branch. And I think what we all try to do as editors when we're looking at a shot is, just like a carpenter, identify where the grain of the wood is smooth and then where there is a possibility of a vector going off in another direction. That's it in a nutshell. I would counterpoint it with the way editing is taught at a kind of elementary level, which is to use match action. Somebody is sitting somewhere and they get up. An exercise in editing 101 is let the actor get up and then in the wider shot, find that same point where the actor is halfway up and cut, and that's a match action. Mm-hmm. And that was used particularly in the early days of continuity editing. People still use it. It's almost a reflex, fallback position. I tend not to use it because, for me, all personal, as soon as an action is initiated, the mind of the person watching says, oh, something's happening. And then maybe 3 or 4 or 5 frames later, there's a cut, and now the person says, oh, now something else is happening, and you have to look at the new image and figure out where that continuity expresses itself, and then the action is completed. So there's a kind of stuttering to it.
And which is the paradox of the match cut.
Yeah. It's supposed to hide this moment of the cut, and that's how it was landed on in the early days of film editing. But I prefer, in general, I mean, I do match cuts when it is appropriate, but I prefer to hold a shot until action, I feel, is inevitable. Something's going to happen, and then I cut to the other angle and initiate the action and let it complete itself.
Mm-hmm. You once told me you thought that match cutting was like blowing smoke across the edit.
Yeah, and this was in the early days of film. We're talking 120 years ago, when the idea that you could cut from one shot to another occurred to people, which was not at the beginning of motion pictures. Motion pictures for the first 12 years of their lives were really just single shots, like cat videos on YouTube.
The train coming at you down the tracks.
That's it. The filmmakers were nervous. Will people really accept this? And so they either did very short dissolves, like 4-frame dissolves from one shot to another, or this idea of match action cutting, which seemed to kind of make a little moment of confusion, because in the early days, editing wasn't valued for what it could contribute as ideas, the juxtaposition of ideas. It was just something that you had to do. It was like a prosthetic, you know, like false teeth or a false leg. Well, we have to do this because we have one shot and we have to find a way to get to the other shot because we can't do it all in one shot. And in the book, I make an analogy with what happens in poetry. You know, where do you decide to end a line at a significant moment, not just an arbitrary moment, but a secretly significant moment? The last word of that line of poetry has a kind of glow about it because it's exposed to the whiteness of the page. With that idea, your eyes go then to the first word of the next line, and those two things get married to each other in a way that's very different if you just are writing prose, where that all the words are buried in a big sandwich of text.
The idea of that last word in a piece of poetry is similar to something we've talked about before, which is the importance of that last frame before you cut to the
very,
next shot.
Very similar. At the end of a shot where the editor has decided, okay, I'm going to cut there, if that image is revealing of something about the character or about the story, and then you cut, the cut itself is such a brutal thing, really. You're taking, in an instant, taking something away from the audience and giving them something else, that I believe the mind of the audience says, something just happened, and I have to remember that, subconsciously at least. And if you choose not only where the right moment is, rhythmically within the shot, and hopefully also choose an image that has a kind of iconographic importance to it. Not always, obviously, but enough, it will allow the audience to have a deeper understanding of what the film is about.
I think we talked about the fact that you used to make notes or like a pen on the film to say, I want to print this picture out. And a lot of those were final images and shots that you chose.
Yes, in the old pre-digital days, when the dailies or the rushes come in, one of the first things I do is select a frame or a few frames representative of why did they shoot this shot? What key moments of this shot? Not only physically, but emotionally. You know, we're after that kind of a reaction. Well, then I would scan through the film very quickly on the Steenbeck or the Chem and go, yep, oh, that's a good one. And I would take a Sharpie and just draw a black line on the other side of the sprockets. And then I'd give it to my assistant, who would then take a picture of that. He would just be looking for these Sharpie marks. But what I found when I was preparing the film for negative cutting, I would be going through it and, oh look, without even thinking about it, that black line is right on the frame cut or within a frame or two of it. Again, subconsciously, something was going on in my mind that had identified that frame as having a kind of glow about it.
So we went from match frames, and then the Soviet style is basically the opposite, right?
Right. Yeah, they were after the collision of ideas. I mean, the classic example is the man's face and then a bowl of soup and then the man's face again. And
the Kuleshov effect.
The Kuleshov thing. That had resonance with Hegelian dialectics, where you take A and B and the person thinks C, which is about the collision of these two ideas. And, you know, our films are a fusion of those two different approaches.
In the book, it said, the more jolts, the better.
Yeah, yeah. They wanted to wake the audience up. And what they would accuse us of doing was putting the audience to sleep, intellectually speaking.
Sure. The more jolts, the better makes me think of, like, Raging Bull. You know,
yeah.
Where the edits are violent in themselves.
Yeah. There's a great line from Thelma where somebody said, how can you work on Marty's films when they're so violent? And she said, they're not violent until I start cutting them.
In your discussion of the movie, The Conversation,
Yeah. You
mentioned a specific cut where Harry pushed a stop button, but instead of matching action, it went from Harry's look to the click of realization, symbolized by the release. What does that edit have to teach editors?
It's a Kuleshovian moment. It is him realizing something, and then you cut without any match action. It's a definite, the more cut, the better. You cut to the tape recorder releasing the pinch wheel, and that actually goes along with the title of the book. Suddenly something clicked. He just realized, I missed something. There was a hidden thing here that makes this tape dangerous. And then you go back to Harry and he's doing stuff, but it's that moment of the realization, which is represented by the keeper wheel suddenly springing off the thing. And it was a cut that I did not do. I had asked Pat Jackson, my assistant, to do a paper cut of that scene, and I was mixing American Graffiti at the time, and I asked her to do that, and she made that cut. And as soon as I saw it, I thought, that's the key to this film. That is something about, stylistically, about that film. So I salute Pat every time I see that cut.
You mentioned that it was a paper cut, and I've talked to several editors who obviously were cutting on film where it took effort, like serious effort, to make the choices you're going to make. And many of them did paper cuts. Carol Littleton is one of them. I know you probably can't remember what your paper cut was, but what would you have written down?
Just a list of the shots with whatever the slate was on that shot. Start with this, and then after he says this line, try cutting to this shot, the close-up of the hands on the keyboard. It was just something to get her started, or get yourself started. I still do that in a sense. I don't just start cutting. I have looked at everything and I've made notes and I've highlighted, oh, these are good moments. And then I sort of go into a zone and I just think about how could this go together? You plan it out. But as Eisenhower said, planning is everything, plans are nothing. It's important to go through the exercise of planning, but once you actually engage in battle, once you actually start cutting, then other things happen. And you can't say, no, I won't do that because I planned it this way. Be always open to stuff that happens in battle as you're working.
And that's one of the quotes that's in the book, right, at the bottom?
Yes, it's another bottom of the page quote.
Many editors say, I just cut where it feels right. And I've done many interviews where people say that, and I always push.
Yeah.
So you say, but we're really predicting the audience's reaction, the key to which is that thinking and reacting take time.
Yeah.
Here's the example that I would love for you to talk about. You mentioned Harry Call walking into his big empty area.
Right.
How long do you hold that shot?
Yeah.
How long do you let him walk away from the camera? Well, you explain, right, that you're trying to figure out what the audience is wondering.
That's it. Francis shot the conversation using multiple cameras at times, and he also shot huge amounts of footage. So I could have continued that shot and let him go all the way into the caged area and then cut to him taking off his coat, saying hello to John Cazale, who plays Stan. But at a certain point, you just say, why am I still looking at this shot? And what that means is one of the obligations of the editor in a sense is the ombudsman of the audience. You're representing the interests of the audience. And to do that, you have to think what the audience is thinking as much as you can. And that shot is a dolly shot that takes Gene Hackman, Harry Call, out of the elevator in profile and then comes to a stop and then he walks away from the camera. This is the first time we've seen where Harry works. And it's an interesting space. It's a warehouse that's largely empty and there's something at the far end of it. The audience will think, oh, that's interesting. I wonder what it is and what he does there and cut. You know, something like that. The difficulty is knowing where exactly is that point. One of the techniques that I talk about also in the book is using the time code, or when we worked on the Moviola, using the footage counter. And so you run the shot with your hand on the brake, so to speak, or the space bar, and you're thinking the audience's thoughts, and you go, cut. And it's a musical moment, you know? It's like your dad was a clarinetist and he's holding the note, and when does the next note come in? You know, that long note at the beginning of Rhapsody in Blue. You know, how long really do you hold that until it shifts? That's what we're doing. We're holding that note and then shifting to something else. Another instrument comes in, which is Harry taking off his raincoat. So play it, hold that note in your mind, and then hit the space bar or the brake in the old days, and now look at the time code or look at the footage counter. And it's just arbitrary. It's just wherever it happened to land, 35, 10, 1 or something, you know. And then do it again. Run it again, and you're thinking, and dunk. Now look at it. Where are you? What does it say now? Is it on the money? Or is it a few frames later? Or a few frames earlier? Or wildly different? So what you're doing is you're narrowing in on the the decisive moment, the end of the clarinet, so to speak. It's a good thing, especially in the early days of working on a film, because you're trying to pick up and internalize the rhythms of the film, both in terms of the acting and in terms of the camera work and in terms of the story beats. Say you do it and the second time it was 6 frames later. You think, well, yeah, it did feel a little longer that time. Well, what you've just done is quantified for this film what 6 frames are. For this shot in this film, that's what 6 frames are.
Because 6 frames will feel different in a different shot.
Yeah,
in
another film, 6 frames would be different. In another place in this film, it would be different. But for this moment, and every time we do that as editors, we are collecting information about what is the rhythmic signature of this film, which is, using musical terms, exactly what a conductor does when they're figuring out, how am I going to conduct this piece of music? How fast am I going to go? And where am I going to change the rhythm during the same movement? Again, this is exactly what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, you zero in on it, and eventually you will surprise yourself that you'll land on the same frame. You think, well, wait a minute, that shot is 12 seconds long. How can I land on the same frame?
Mm-hmm.
You can only do it if you approach it musically as a rhythmic thing. And the rhythm is the audience's thoughts, because visually nothing much is happening. We're looking at this space for the first time. Even more appropriate example of that is Talented Mr. Ripley, after Matt Damon has killed Jude Law and sunk the rowboat. He's up on shore and we're on his back looking out to sea, and we know that the boat is down there somewhere. So we're looking at the back of Matt Damon's head, and he's got a blanket or a towel around, something around him. There's no expression, there's no movement at all. It's basically a still frame except for the waves. But what he's thinking and what you want the audience to think is, I just killed this guy and I loved him, and now what am I going to do? Holy shit. How many beats does that thought have? And I use the same technique. You know, you hold it, thinking those thoughts, look at the time code, do it a couple of times, you'll narrow in on that frame.
It goes back to that idea that you mentioned of letting the audience have some space to wonder what he's
Absolutely.
Thinking. Half the audience is going to think something different than the other half.
Yeah. And that frame is a node. I mean, again, what you're identifying is one of those branch points where the tree, so to speak, is getting ready to send off something in the other direction.
Now, do you think that idea of trees and nodes is that a shot has more than one location where you can diverge from the shot?
Absolutely.
Like, oh, I could get out of this early, but if I'm going to go out later, I have to go another 7 or 8 seconds before
I can... You can cut 24 times a second. I mean, there are 24 frames every second where you could cut, but only two of those might be nodes, because if you pass the first node and you don't cut, you allow the audience to think another thought, another beat. And you don't want to interrupt them while they're thinking that new thought. You want to allow that thought, whatever it is, or the action, if it's overt, to reach a certain maturity. Then you will arrive at another node.
You also mentioned that translating language is similar to editing, and I love that idea.
Yeah. I'm fortunate enough to have competence in French and Italian. And after English Patient, I was giving an interview with a poetry magazine who had decided to write about film as poetry. In the middle of that interview, just like this one, I came to this idea. Well, in a sense, we filmmakers are translating from one language, which is the language of text, which is words on a page. We're translating into another language, which is images that move in time with sound. And just like every picture is worth 1,000 words, sometimes every word is worth 1,000 pictures. You know, each one has very different efficiencies. And we are navigating those efficiencies when we make a film, just like a translator does. Well, in Polish, there is a word for the day after tomorrow, a single word. We don't have that in English. We have to say the day after tomorrow, you know, seven syllables to say, and I've forgotten what that word is in Polish, but it's probably two or three syllables. And so we are impoverished in English there, but probably the opposite is true as well. And so when you're translating from one language to another, and after I gave that interview, I thought, well, I should do it. And so I started translating some Italian prose, and for some peculiar reason, it flipped in my translation into blank verse, poetry.
Instead of writing sentences.
Right, instead of a solid block of paragraph of text, which it was in Italian, it started to look like how long is each shot of a film. Your mind, when you're translating, is doing exactly what we do when we're editing a film. Well, I used that shot before, so I don't need this shot anymore, but I could use that shot to get the idea across, but the emotion in the other shot, how, if I use that, then I have to get rid of this, and you know, you're playing this kind of game of Tetris, sliding things until it suddenly locks into place.
Do you think that's one of the reasons why, that translation is one of the reasons why so many great scripts, I mean, people spend a lot of time developing a script. A lot of very smart people do that. And then you get the script and it doesn't work in the editing room quite the way. I mean, it might be good, but it doesn't work the same way.
Yeah.
It's that translation possibly.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many variables. I make the point elsewhere in the book that film is not an art. It's a meta art. It's an art of arts. And there's so many things going on depending on who did you cast in the role. I mean, imagine The Godfather starring Robert Redford as Michael, which is what Paramount wanted. Here's a guy who has a line of dialogue where he says, "That's my family, Kay, it's not me." And you look at Robert Redford and you say, "So? You're the cowboy, you know, you've got red blonde hair, and all the other people look like Italians." But when Al Pacino says it, who is Sicilian, you say, "Well, that's interesting. Why does somebody who looks like that say that line?" Piece of genius casting for all of The Godfather, but it just has to do with that tension.
You mentioned that one of the examples of a nodal cut is the Lawrence of Arabia match cut to the desert.
It's absolutely the opposite of a match cut. It
was supposed to be a dissolve.
In the script, it's a dissolve. Robert Bolt said Lawrence blows out a match. There's a little puff of smoke, and the design was dissolve to the sunrise. And Ann Coates obeyed the script, and as we did in those days, drew probably a 6-foot grease pencil mark diagonally across the film, and the cut happened right in the middle of that. So she was showing David Lean the assembly of that scene, and they looked at it, and both of them, at the moment of the cut, jumped out of their chair and said, "Get rid of those grease pencils. That's a great cut." Arguably, if they had been editing digitally, they wouldn't have seen that cut, because Anne would have made a dissolve, and the script said dissolve, there it is, let's move on to the next thing. But because of the primitive nature of editing back in...
Waiting for an optical to come back.
Yeah, in the work print, you just see these terribly looking grease pencil lines, and you know intellectually that is going to be a dissolve, and you filmmakers imagine it as much as you can. But then you have to identify the shots, send the negative out to make an interpositive, use the interpositive to make a new internet, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And it takes days, sometimes weeks, before you see the result of that. And so it's just one of those fortuitous things that arose out of the primitiveness of the technology itself.
And never scrub to find an edit point.
That's one of my rules. A simple example, somebody walks away from the camera, opens a door, and closes the door behind them. Where do you cut? And one way to do it is what we call scrubbing, which is just to move the film in the viewer back and forth, and you can, okay, that is where the door is closed, but you've chosen a frame that doesn't have anything to do with the inherent rhythm of the shot itself. You've just analyzed intellectually, the door is now closed, cut. So I never do that. I would urge people not to do it, but everyone to their own decisions. But again, I just get back to what we were talking about earlier. He's walking through the door. The moment of the cut in that case is probably where it is inevitable that the door will close, but it hasn't yet closed. In musical terms, you're cutting on a rising potential. The next shot receives that potential and does something with it. If you want to make a definite point about this, like, I'll never see you again, well, then you do allow the door to close, and then you probably hold on the closed door for a number of frames, letting the audience think. It's the moment that the plane takes off. It's going down the runway, and at a certain point, it is inevitable that it will either take off or it will crash, and that's the moment of the cut. When somebody exits frame left, it's similar to the door close. It could be that before they reach this point, just like Columbo, he turns and says, but one more thing. And we know, okay, this is the key thing that's going to unravel the whole mystery. But once you're past that moment, you can't come back. And so that's a cut point. Unless you want to say, again, like the door, he's gone and he will never come back. So let him go, hold on the empty frame. Francis used that just as a counterexample in the conversation, because one of the stylistic things about the film, this is the early days of video surveillance. He wanted Bill Butler, let Gene leave the frame and hold on the empty frame as if you are a surveillance camera that has been programmed to respond to movement within the frame. So now somebody's left frame, you're holding, the little computer is thinking, I will hold for 2 seconds and then I will search for the person. So it makes the camera, purposely, it makes the camera stupid. I'm not going to pan with him. I'm not going to cut as soon as he leaves. I'm just going to hold empty. And that creates anxiety in the audience, which is what we want. Why are we not looking? And so we do find him. He sits down on the sofa, and then he takes off his trousers, which is another, what? Now what's going to happen? And then he gets up and leaves that frame, and we hold on him, but he comes back into it. You know. So we're playing a game, but it's part of the stylistic approach of the film.
In film, you have to cut to another shot that continues the story more effectively. I love that idea. For example, you were mentioning like the Harry Call shot. He walks away, and then to continue the story, what's the next best shot that continues the story?
Right.
Oh, he walks into his laboratory or his...
Right. It's technically what I call a skip cut. It's not a jump cut. My definition of a jump cut is a cut internal to a shot that moves somebody forward. The classic examples from Breathless by Godard, riding in the car, you don't, jump, jump. Here, he hasn't yet gotten to the caged area, the work area, and we cut, and now he's already in the caged area taking off his raincoat. And it's the gesture of that removal of the raincoat that kind of wipes you into that shot.
And so many people talk about, for those that are so driven by match cutting, that would make that scene boring because you would have to wait those extra 5 seconds of nothingness
right.
to be able to get it to match.
Yeah, that was my approach to the editing of the film, in a sense impelled by the fact that Francis kept shots so long. That meant if we did that, the film would be 4.5 hours long. So how are we going to accelerate it? A counterexample of that, when I was working with Fred Zinnemann on Julia, so this is 1976-ish, Jane Fonda or Vanessa Redgrave would be walking away from camera. They would cross a threshold, a doorway or something, and he would say, cut. They had been told that means stop. It was awkward. The first time I thought, well, that's weird, because Francis would allow them to go through the threshold and then close the door just in case, who knows, maybe we could use it, you know. We'll decide later, but Fred would not let them go complete the action. And finally, after a week or so of this in dailies, I knocked on his door of the trailer and said, okay, you know, I can't help but wonder what is happening here. Why do you not let them go through? It was like I had uncovered a slightly painful memory of his, and he said, because then she could recut my film. And I said, who is she? And he said, Margaret Booth, who, because he grew up as a young filmmaker at MGM, and all of the young filmmakers were desperately afraid of Margaret Booth, who was the editor of all editors. And if there was some problem with your film, you would arrive one morning and your name would be off the door and she would be recutting your movie under her own dictates. So he and a lot of that generation did things to prevent the recut of the movie. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, if I let them go through the door and the door closed, I could come and watch the premiere of the film and find that they'd shot a whole new scene on the other side of that closed door. So he never gave them the closed door, so to speak.
I heard something similar with coverage back when the studio started saying you had to shoot coverage, and John Ford, I can't remember, he used to put his hand in front of the camera because he would say, that way they can't use the part that I don't want to let him use.
I mean, they're roughly the same generation.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about your love affair with the Moviola.
Just a week ago, we did the final color timing on a short documentary, hour-long documentary called Her Name Was Moviola. And I realized about 12, 15 years ago, something like that, that there was no visual documentation of actually what it took to take a scene from raw footage that just came in from the lab to edited scene. If you were cutting the way we used to cut on an analog system, the most analog of all is the Moviola. And so I got together with Howard Berry, who was head of post-production at University of Hertfordshire, which is up near Elstree, where the MGM studio was, and where George shot Star Wars, where we shot Julia, where I shot Return to Oz. It's that neck of the woods. And he thought this was a good idea, and so we crowdfunded for $30,000 or something. This idea of shooting this movie.
I chipped in.
Yeah. What you see on screen is me and my assistant Dan Farrell, who I've worked with since Return to Oz in England. So I approached Mike Lee, the British director, and he had shot Mr. Turner about 10 years ago, and I think it was his first digital film that he shot digitally. And I explained what we were doing, and I said, can we have the files of your film? And we will take two scenes from that, all of the rushes, all of the dailies, print those two scenes in 35 millimeter image and sound. And then we will pretend that you, Mike Lee, are shooting this film right now, and Dan and I, in our recreated 1972 editing room with all of that ancient equipment, get this material, and now what do we do? Well, the first thing is Dan has to put it in sync, because The sound and the picture are two separate things, and there's a machine called a synchronizer that helps you do that. And so he's wired up, just like I am right now, and I'm wired up, and we go through each of those stages, not exhaustively, but enough to give you the idea of what did you actually do. And then once you've got it in sync, you have to code it. You have to print numbers on the side of both the image and the sound in order that it can stay in sync when you're editing. And then at a certain point, I take over and talk about the moviola, how you worked it, and now we're going to edit all that material. It was about 80 minutes of dailies that condensed down to about a 7-minute scene. So it was a cutting ratio of about 10 to 1. In the end, we go out to Stanley Kubrick's estate, where there is a Steenbeck that he used on The Shining. Howard is the advisor to the Kubrick archive. So then Mike Lee comes in, and so I show him the scenes that I've edited, and he comments upon my decisions and the whole process of editing on analog. That's it. We just submitted it to the Cannes Film Festival because they have a section called Cannes Classics, which is dedicated to showing films about filmmaking. And we hope we get in.
I hope so too. I was shocked to read in the book that you almost couldn't make that documentary anymore because of the materials that you needed to print the edge code and all that kind of stuff.
It took him about a year and a half. The easiest thing to get was the moviola because they're kind of like...
There's a bunch of them.
They're iconic. Even in a completely digital outfit, you go into the office and there in the waiting room is a moviola.
I've got one.
Yeah. So that was easy. What was not easy was what we called mag stripe, which is 35 millimeter film that has a stripe of iron oxide on it where the sound is. Basically, it's like a tape from a tape recorder, except it's film. Basically, nobody has used any of this for the last 20 years. We eventually found some here in Los Angeles, actually, but it was their last 10 rolls that somehow had been forgotten. And they said, what do you want this stuff for? And the other thing that was difficult was this machine that stamps or actually almost burns the numbers into the film every foot, every 16 frames, relies on a pressure-sensitive, heat-sensitive tape that makes the print. And again, nobody had this. And ironically, the place that did have some of it was Pixar. Why they had that, I don't know. But if we hadn't been able to get either of those two things, we couldn't have made the film. You know, it's like, for want of a nail, the shoe is lost. For want of a shoe, the horse is lost. For want of a horse, the kingdom, you know, all of that.
And you mentioned shooting ratios. It's one of the things that you mentioned in the book. You know, the Golden Age had like 10 to 1. Julia, you said, was 34 to 1. Apocalypse Now at 95 to 1. Mad Max Fury Road at 240 to 1. What does that do to the art of editing?
It complicates it. But, you know, it can complicate it in a good way. Apocalypse Now was 95, Coup 53, that documentary was...
266 to 1 is what the book says.
266, yeah, up there with Mad Max. We were swamped enough with Apocalypse Now, but there were two, three, sometimes four editors on Apocalypse Now at 95 to 1, and it took us 2 years to lock the film. With something like Mad Max or Coup 53, there's no way you could do that unless you were editing digitally. So it just increases the options that you have. One of the big differences between editing a unscripted documentary and a scripted fiction film is that in a documentary, you have an abundance of events, but a paucity of coverage. And with a fiction film, it's exactly the opposite. You have an abundance of interpretation of coverage. You know, maybe you have four setups for a scene and you shoot seven takes for each setup. That's already 28 different line readings, slightly different line readings, different lenses, different camera positions. And so the editor has to navigate through that abundance to find just the right line reading with the right lens at the right moment. But you only have the events that are in the screenplay. Whereas in a documentary, especially an unscripted one, you have a huge number of potential scenes and you have to editorially figure out this is better than this and both of these are better than that as a scene. So that's the world we live in at the moment, is that the cost of shooting in terms of the media is negligible. I mean, it always, in terms of how much each day cost, the cost of film was not the main consideration, but it was a consideration.
It was 100 people standing around.
Right. So the 100 people outweigh the 100 feet going through the camera. We have that same situation on steroids now with digital. And it's also what we have now is the proliferation of what we call resets. So, okay, here we go, take two. And you start through it, and 10 seconds in, the director says, just go back a little bit and repeat that line a little louder. And the actor has to do that, and then say the line louder, and you go for another 20 seconds, and then the director says, take a little more pause before you say that. And it's all in one take. It's, I think on Tomorrowland, the record was 35 resets within the same shot, which creates a whole dilemma of how do you keep track of all that. And it's very hard for the script supervisors.
I wanted to mention a couple of things, since the book is also includes, of course, your background is in sound as well. And I wanted to talk about one thing, Barton Fink, the power of leaving room in the script and in the film for sound to tell the story. I love that. Can you talk a little bit about the value of that and how editors can use sound to help tell the story?
Well, this is the big secret of cinematic sound, is that it's much less expensive than image, and it sneaks into the audience's mind sideways. I mean, for some poetic reason, our ears are on the side of our head and our eyes face forward, and we hear in 360 degrees, and we only see, I can't see what's behind me right now, but I can hear what's behind me. I didn't work on Barton Fink. That chapter is a hymn of praise to Skip Leafsay, but also to the Coen brothers, because when you read the script, many, many things are keyed to the sound of what's being heard by the audience. It's one of the most audiophilic screenplays I've ever read. You know, they just did a wonderful job. The advantage of sound is that it can get into the imagined head of the person that you're looking at. Even though on a certain level you know that sound is not in the person's head, but because you're looking at the person and hearing this sound, inevitably we see patterns in clouds. And so when we hear a sound and look at a human face, we inevitably, if the sound is a good, well chosen, we merge those two things. And Barton Fink is full of that kind of stuff.
Last question that I want to ask about is, well, two, if you wouldn't mind. Controlling reverb. You mentioned that it's like reverb's ability has an ability like depth of field.
Right.
Can you talk about that? And do you actually do that in your picture cuts, or is that strictly when you're in a mixing stage?
I think about it during the editing, because I know that I'm going to be at the mix or mixing the film, and so I'm constantly, it's one of those translational things. I'm thinking, I can't solve this problem visually, but I can solve it with sound. Therefore, I won't beat myself up that I can't solve this visually. But I know if I choose the right sound, that will help get me over the hump or whatever it is.
But you don't bother doing it in the picture cut. You just know you have the ability someplace else.
Yeah. Exactly. So the nature of reverb is that when I'm speaking, my voice is hitting the wall of this room and it's bouncing off the wall at a slight delay, and that's contributing to how the audience is hearing what I'm saying. It's minimal in this case. If we were in a tiled room, the bounce would be more pronounced because the tile doesn't absorb the sound, it just kicks it back. It's one of those things that when you start working in sound, you sensitize yourself to inevitably because it's a great tool. Reverb smooths the edges of things. In a sound that has no reverb, as soon as the voice or whatever it is stops, that is the end. But with reverb, there's a little tail. It's echo. The difference between reverb and echo, echo is a definite slap. Hello, hello, how are you, you know. Whereas reverb is a series of very quick echoes, a whole series of very quick echoes that all merge into, and they have a color to them, and that's how you tell this person is in the bathroom, or this person is in the dressing room, or this person is in the cathedral. They all have different reverbs. So it helps to increase the feeling of where you are, and creatively you can play with that and disorient an audience by showing them in a space that should have reverb and take away all the reverb. You know, that's one of those ambiguities we were talking about. Why would they do that? Well, because they're trying to create an interior space and de-emphasize physically where they are. And just the opposite. You can show somebody speaking and they speak with a big reverb, but there is no reason for that. Well, why?
And you gave the example of American Graffiti, the music in the background, that you added reverb to the music so that it kind of mushed out.
It right, softened. It's that mushy, there are no hard edges to it. And the more reverb you add, the more everything blends in with everything else. The whole purpose of the film was to have, I think it's 42 songs, and almost endlessly. There are two scenes that don't have any of this, but everywhere else, music is always playing because it's all coming from Wolfman Jack's radio show and everyone is turned to his show. That's the concept. But you have dialogue scenes. You want to hear the dialogue clearly, but if you have music playing at the same time, that interferes with the ability to hear the dialogue. So what do you do? Well, you lower the music. At a certain point, it's so low that you wonder, why is it here at all? By adding this realistic reverb, and we went to great pains to make it, the quality of the reverb match what we were looking at. We're inside a car, or we're out on the street, or we're at Mel's drive-in, all have different, or the gymnasium, they're all different. What this allows you to do is to have the voices in the foreground, so to speak, without any reverb, and the music actually playing fairly loudly, but because there are no sharp edges to it, there's nothing for the ear to grab onto. So the brain hears the music but ignores it. Mm. You hear it subconsciously, but you're not paying attention to it. And that allows the dialogue to be clear. We were at the point of the first assembly, Verna Fields, famous editor who edited Jaws for Spielberg, who was also a teacher of ours at USC, she came up to help George and Marcia get the first assembly together. She had to go back. She had a film to edit. Anyway, she took me aside and said, Walter, please tell George to drop this idea of all of these songs. Have a few of them, but not all, the audience is going to be driven crazy. It's a wonderful story, great characters, but you're ruining it with all this music. And I said, well, we have a plan. And I'd experimented with this technique on THX, actually on some student films as well, but THX and Godfather has it in the wedding scene. That's full of this same approach. But it allows you to have your cake and eat it too, in the sense that you don't have to reduce the music too low, but because you're not giving it any edges while the dialogue is happening, it's the equivalent of depth of field of photography, where if you're shooting a close-up of somebody, a portrait, you want their face to be in focus, and behind them is a rose garden. You don't want those roses to be in focus, so you choose a long lens, 75 millimeter lens or something, and narrow the depth of field so that the face is in focus, the roses are there, but they're just kind of colorful, mushy shapes. So we did the same thing with the music. And then at the end of the scene, you dial back the reverb and bring the music up full and for maximum impact. If we kept that same amount of reverb when the music was loud, it would get chaotic. So it allowed us to navigate those changes from in focus and out of focus.
Walter, thank you so much for your time today. Sure, it was absolutely fascinating to hear about, and I hope that everybody has a chance to pick up your book, Suddenly Something Clicked.
Suddenly Something Clicked. This is something that Maxim Gorky wrote when he was seeing his first movie in 1896. The Lumiere brothers had come to his hometown, which was subsequently named for him because he became a famous author. But he was sitting in the audience in a brothel, interestingly, which is the only place that would allow this to happen. And they hung up a bed sheet at one end of the room, the central salon. And the first shot was a street scene in Lyon of just pedestrians and carriages and bicycles. He was watching that, and he was not impressed because he wanted to see color and he wanted sound. Then he wrote, "Suddenly something clicked," and in an instant, the street scene in Lyon disappeared, and now you were 400 kilometers to the south, in the south of France, and a train was arriving at a station. And what he had heard was the splice going through the projector, which in those days there was a double overlap, and it made a clack when it went through. And it's the first time anyone ever wrote about the moment of a cut from one shot to another in a motion picture.
I love it. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support, clips, and trailers, head on over to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to Walter Murch, ACE, for joining us on Art of the Cut. Don't forget to look for his new book, Suddenly Something Clicked, when it comes out later this year. And thanks to our partner, Boris FX, and to our sponsor, Jump Desktop. Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com and jumpdesktop.com/cut. I'm Steve Holfish, ACE. Thanks for listening. And please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut interviews every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And if you want a good follow on socials, I'm on Twitter and Instagram as @SteveHolfish. I hope my posts on editing wisdom give you something to think about. See you out there.